I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. Today I'm talking to Chel Ravens, the head of audio at Navarra Media and one of the presenters of the No Tags podcast. She had a piece in a recent issue of the LRB on the history of rave in the UK. It's a review of Party Lines, Dance Music and the Making of Modern Britain by Ed Gillett. Hello, Chel, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Hello.
So shall we begin with the origin story, or the founding legend, as you put it, of how Acid House came to Britain from Ibiza in 1987, even if the truth is perhaps a bit more complicated than that story.
Yes. So throughout the book, Ed Gillett is quite careful to point out all the ways in which the passed down legend of dance music might differ from all of the things that actually happened. And so this founding legend is about a group of men who became known as the Ibiza Four. And so they were Danny Rampling, Paul Oakenfold, Johnny Walker and Nicky Holloway. And in the 80s, they were all DJing and they decided to go on a holiday to Ibiza, which was definitely some kind of destination for dance music at that time, but not yet what it would grow into in the 90s. And they went on this holiday, they took ecstasy, they went to a club called Amnesia, which in those days was an open air club, and they watched a DJ called Alfredo play. And Alfredo is part of a kind of legend of acid house because he plays this style of music which comes to be known as Balearic, as in the Balearic Islands. And what Balearic really means, although sometimes people think it just means a sort of chilled out island sound, but what it really means is to play a mixture of different music. So they heard this mix of new wave, of disco, of this new house music that was coming over from America at the time. Often Balearic music could include actual pop music. I think maybe things like George Michael might have been played. And this sort of blew their minds, probably partly because they'd taken their first pills. And they decided that they had to come back to London and start their own parties in this vein. And this is the beginning of what becomes known as the Second Summer of Love. And individually, they start separate parties, which are quite influential in their own right. Danny Rampling starts a night called Shoom, which is extremely exclusive, but influential and important. Paul Oakenfold ends up becoming a superstar DJ in his own right. The founding myth gets cemented, I think, partly in Simon Reynolds' book, Energy Flash, which is one of the few kind of definitive histories that we already had of this period. I suppose one reason why it's a legend rather than a true story is that it kind of erases some of the things that were already happening in the UK, particularly in the north of England. It's a very media-focused story. It's a very London-focused, home counties kind of story. And in Manchester, in particular, house music, black house music from Chicago, already had a presence. And it was played at nights where black people were present themselves. For instance, at the Hacienda in the mid-80s, before the Second Summer of Love and before it became this central node of Manchester, Hacienda was a black club, essentially, or at least a black-friendly club. And there was loads of house music being played there. So the legend is real, but I think that what Party Lines tries to do is show some of the other tributaries into rave culture at that time. So you had particularly black sound system culture, which can be traced back to blues dances in the 60s. And you also had free festival culture, which had turned into the new traveller culture. So Windsor Free Festival in the 70s, Stonehenge, the huge gatherings at Stonehenge every year. And sound system music was already present in these places. So what the Ibiza 4 did was turbocharge it with a more conceptual framing, I think. And at the same time, ecstasy was arriving in the UK.
And then there was this explosion in the summer of 1988, this second summer of love, the first summer of love obviously being 1967. And at that point, people, they weren't only going out dancing in nightclubs like the Hacienda, right? They were also breaking into empty warehouses and having illegal parties, so-called, in these spaces. And I wonder how important the fact that there were so many empty warehouses, sort of as a symptom of post-industrial decline, was to the scene.
Yeah, I think that's crucial in a way. The warehouse parties, again, I think were already happening in the 80s. The existing scenes, like the Rare Groove scene, for example, which was playing old soul and funk records, that would often happen in warehouses as well as in clubs in the cities. I think the existence of these empty warehouses is, you know, not coincidental. And it's interesting if you map it onto what was happening in Detroit at the time, Detroit being the birthplace of techno and famously a rapidly industrial and rapidly post-industrial city, where half the inhabitants had evacuated the town effectively by the mid-80s. And Detroit techno is in many ways really about this post-industrial decline, this emptiness, these empty machinic landscapes. And so I think that to some extent, Britain had its own equivalent of that. The fact that places like Blackburn and Leeds ended up being hotspots of the acid house phenomenon is not coincidental. There were these ugly edgeland sites with big empty buildings almost waiting to be broken into and used, really.
And the media response at first was quite positive and then rapidly became very negative, shall we say?
Yeah, just about. I mean, so The Sun runs a T-shirt giveaway. Acid House is groovy. They've got these groovy T-shirts printed up. They're just seeing it as a novelty, as just another kind of kids' craze that's happening. But that really doesn't last very long at all. It's barely a year in between the groovy T-shirt giveaway and a headline calling for evil acid barons to be shot. In the early 90s, you also have several early ecstasy drug deaths, which kind of turbocharges the hatred towards acid house. I think, though, that the newspapers were geared up to see acid house not just as a kind of teenage phenomenon or musical trend, but as part of a very loose countercultural bloc that would have been the target of the tabloid press at the time anyway. So very quickly, and not without reason, rave gets wrapped up into this, again, sort of very loose bloc that might include particularly football hooligans. There's, again, part of the founding legend is that tons of football hooligans did an E, decided that they didn't want to glass each other anymore, set up pirate radio stations. Not entirely untrue. So you've got football hooligans. You've also got the new age travellers or new travellers, people who had basically given up their lives in the city, or at least part-time given up their lives in the city and decided to live on the road in the summers. And those people would pitch up at festivals like Stonehenge. And within that group, you've also got the Greenham Common kind of CND activists. Travellers were often labelled as peace convoys in the tabloid press, including rave convoys and peace convoys all kind of got blurred together in tabloid lingo, presumably in an attempt really to smear the peace activists rather than the other way around. And you've also got ultimately environmental protesters, hunt saboteurs, road protesters, they kind of come in later. So it's the beginnings of a kind of countercultural block that I think you could also link up to striking miners and this sense of there being an enemy within that needed to be contained.
And I mean, you begin your piece with the account of this, one of the largest mass arrests in British history, that a party called Love Decade in July 1990 in Leeds. And you quote one of the partygoers there saying that the police dealt with them just like the miners, as you said. And you say later that the specialist police team called the Pay Party Unit, whose job was disrupting rave networks, used many of the tactics that had been deployed during the miners' strike. So you can see, I mean, it's fairly clear why the miners' strike, why organised labour was a threat to the British state, to the Thatcher government. But I mean, the question of why they should have been so bothered by ravers, who you could perhaps describe as, you know, not organised labour, but disorganised leisure, why was that seen as such a threat?
Yeah, I think this is really the central question of the book, really. It's about many, many things. Different people in the book point to different things as well. So you have someone like Alan Lodge, who is a sort of stalwart of this scene. He's a hippie who's involved in the free festivals. He then provides welfare services at the Stonehenge gatherings. He then ends up part of the campaign against the Criminal Justice Act in the early 90s. And Alan Lodge's take on it is that there's something really fundamental going on here, that it's a question of hunter-gatherers against farmers, between nomads and settlers. And he suggests that there's something almost irresolvable there, that if people want to just live on the road, why can't they? And we live in a society that won't let you do that. And obviously we see, you know, even today, deeper and deeper clampdowns on travellers' way of life. But there are other things too. I mean, there's a sense of dirt and pollution. You know, that's something that is definitely thrown at this rave traveller block a lot, that they create filth in their wake. And then there are sort of deeper questions about this idea of what you might call collective festivity, this sense that there's something going on here that can't be captured by the economic or social system that we're in. There's something going on here where hierarchy is dissolved, where your money is useless, because by the early 90s, you had the emergence of free parties, which maybe weren't exactly free, but perhaps there'd be a bucket, you were expected to make a donation. But they were free in an ideological sense as well. A lot of these sound system parties really believed in the point of running a party that everybody could come to and not pay any money, to create a space where your money was no good, actually. And so that sense of the collective festivity that's kind of troubling the edges of how society actually functions, I think is quite a big part of it. And Ed Gillett goes on to explain, you know, some further facets of this sense that over the 90s, one of the things that the government was trying to do was to commercially purify rave, to strip out the bits of it that would make money, and to basically ban the bits that were irrelevant to that, or that were considered extraneous. I suppose drugs were obviously a big factor. It would be silly not to acknowledge that. But I think that perhaps in retrospect, or perhaps from a more sort of mainstream view, drugs are a really big part of the reason that raves were banned, were clamped down on. But I don't really think that that's... I'm not sure that really tells us anything much, because obviously drugs remain illegal and drugs are still part of nightlife ultimately. So I think there's something more than just a sense that these kids are, you know, off their heads and making too much noise. There's something a bit deeper about what kind of activities can be tolerated, and also a really fundamental fear of large crowds. You know, a large crowd might soon turn into something more sinister and mob-like if you're in a position that might find that sinister.
I mean, I suppose one thing about the drugs question is that, as it were, city bankers taking cocaine didn't seem to be such a problem, such a threat to the state, that, as it were, those parties were not raided.
No.
The Bunnington Club parties, for example, were not raided by the police. And so there is a social question as well, isn't it? If you're the future leadership of the Tory party, taking drugs and trashing restaurants is acceptable while the...
Oh, absolutely. But that also comes down a bit to what type of drugs we're talking about. So I mean, cocaine is not really a factor in the early acid house scene. What we're talking about is ecstasy, although by no means are all people taking ecstasy. But that isn't the case. It was quite expensive at first. Plenty of people were going out without it.
And there wasn't very much of it either.
No, at first there wouldn't have been. Yeah, and just really quite pricey. So people might have been taking acid, speed, stuff to keep you up for hours and generally, you know, slightly change your perceptions. And acid is still a drug that will change your relationship with the people around you in a certain way that I think is quite different to the way that cocaine will change your relationship to the people around you. So I do think that the type of drugs plays a role. I imagine most people in power had no real idea of what the actual usual effects of ecstasy were at that time. But I'm sure they had a sense that people were taking acid because it was called Acid House. And some of those people would have been old enough to remember what taking acid was like. And the idea of 20,000 people in a field on acid is quite something, you know, that is quite something. And also at the time, you have to remember stuff like Glastonbury, totally different sense of what Glastonbury was about in those days. Glastonbury only sort of normalised itself in the late 90s, early noughties, really. At that time, all of that culture was seen as quite troublesome.
I mean, one of the Sun's famous front pages in June 1989, the headline was "Spaced Out" with an exclamation mark, and then 11,000 youngsters go drug crazy at Britain's biggest ever acid party.
Yeah.
And the photograph, it's a really interesting photograph because it's, I'm not sure what it was meant to say to the most of the Sun's readers at the time, if it's of debauchery or if it's meant to be a shocking photograph. But actually it's, I don't know, it's quite a lovely picture, really.
Well, it has the other effect, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, here's some young people, and what you talk about, there's hierarchies breaking down, that they're black people and white people, and it's very hard to tell what class they are, partly from the clothes they're wearing, and some of them aren't wearing very many clothes at all.
And gender too, sometimes.
And gender, yeah. And it so it does seem to show that disintegration of social divisions that you've been talking about, which...
Yeah, there's also the reporting on Castle Morton when it happens. So Castle Morton ends up being the biggest illegal rave ever and very much the sort of pivotal end of an era moment in 1992. Thousands and thousands of people turning up. But of course they do, because they've seen it on the 6 o'clock news and there's virtually live rolling coverage of it. And so if you're hearing about it on the radio and you live, I don't know, an hour or two up the road and you've seen it on the news and you're looking at it and thinking, well, I don't know, it looks pretty good. And people just drove down. So in a sense, all of the sensationalism around it only advertised it and pushed it further into young people's consciousness, I think.
So there is an argument, and it was made at the time too, that raving wasn't revolutionary, that in some ways it was the opposite of revolutionary. I mean, the LRB had its first piece on, I think it was the first piece, like the first cover piece on Acid House in September 1989. And there's a really great photograph by Beezer of someone who's described as a harlequin of the Acid House scene on the contents page. the piece was by Rose Boyd, and describing the experience, she wrote, "There is nothing inside my head but happiness." But her last line was, "The Acid House phenomenon keeps the people off the streets." But in some ways, Ed Gillett's book is a refutation of that view, right? That the claim that partying isn't political, that it actually was revolutionary, or potentially.
To an extent, I think. I think the book is interested in complicating the picture, but I think it's fair to say that there have always been multiple competing political impulses within rave. On one hand, you have, for example, some of the sort of former football hooligans who decide that they're going to get in on rave. Well, there's a story of one guy who was a Spurs fan. And because of his hooliganism, if I recall rightly, he was actually banned from the ground and the area around the ground. So he needed to find something else to do, ultimately. I'm sure that would have had a bit of an effect, actually, that convicted hooligans who weren't then allowed to participate in football anymore needed a new hobby. But he talks about it being suggested to him that rave is political, that there's some kind of nefarious political undertone to his rave organising. And he's just like, nah, I just want to get off my head, you know. He's not interested in that. He wants to have a party. He wants to have a nice time. But then I think you can go further and say that in that kind of claiming of your right to that kind of collective joy, that there's something, you know, in a small way, quite political about that, even if, as he said, you know, they think I'm Jeremy Corbyn, anachronistically. But he's talking about not feeling as if there's any kind of political thrust to what he's doing. But he's seeing that in big P Westminster terms. But really, I think there is something political about the decision to put effort into this moment of collective festivity. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you know, very quickly after the Acid House moment, organised crime elements did move into the scene. And so within a few years, you had not only the Pay Party unit trying to shut you down, but actually you were perhaps often fending off criminal elements who wanted to infiltrate your party, I suppose extort you, sell their own drugs and so on. The idea that that needed some kind of policing is perhaps not wrong, you know. And then again, you have a massive difference between the free party ideology of sound systems like the DIY collective, who are doing it as a kind of anarchist gesture, or more than gesture, they were creating anarchist, you know, quote unquote, temporary autonomous zones. But then contrasted with that, you have people like the infamous Tony Colston-Hayter, who runs the Sunrise parties and is just an out-and-out Thatcherite. He sees the opportunity to make loads of easy cash and does it. And people, of course, famously like Paul Staines, later Guido Fawkes, who's involved in this scene as well. So I think the point there is just that dance music can contain all of those elements quite easily, and in fact still does. You know, we still have illegal free parties, and we still have the sons of aristocrats and, you know, investment bankers and landlords owning party companies as well.
You talked about Castle Morton being sort of the end of something. And then 2 years after that, there was the Criminal Justice Act, which famously banned... Was it
a succession of repetitive beats?
Repetitive beats, exactly. Any nocturnal open air gathering of more than 100 people at which amplified music was played.
Yes.
With sounds wholly or predominantly characterised by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats.
Yeah, they really cover their backs there.
Well, you know, it was a legal. Yeah, well, you know, exactly that legal speech. But it's not a bad definition, I suppose.
Yeah.
It slightly takes all the joy out of it. But anyway, and what were the consequences of that in terms of shutting down free parties? And
well, I think the consequences were fairly terminal in some ways. I mean, something like Castle Morton couldn't happen again. But at the same time, there were already moves in the background towards a kind of realignment of what dance music was about. And by the time the bill was passed in 1994, certain things were perhaps in place that were moving dance music into its next phase of commercial purification, if you like. So on one hand, yes, that type of large illegal rave no longer existed. But on the other hand, plenty of large legal raves continued to exist and just got bigger and bigger. You know, you had dance music, huge dance music festivals by the end of the decade. You also had in parallel a gradual relaxing of laws around alcohol licensing. And that had been going on since perhaps the very late 80s, early 90s, not necessarily connected to rave explicitly. But I don't think it's coincidental that magistrates start loosening their licensing decisions, giving out the first 24-hour licenses. That happens in 1991.
And is that trying to get people off the ecstasy and back on the booze?
I'm not sure it's as simple as that, because I think that there would have been a broader social demand for that anyway. I think people in general wanted to, because of course this is, you know, in the late 80s, the change in alcohol licensing, that lets you sit in the pub in the afternoon. So, I mean, I think there's a broader demand for people who just want to sit in the pub in the afternoon that has nothing to do with rave culture necessarily. But I think the introduction of 24-hour licenses, I imagine there was an element of response to rave culture, but there was also probably a thought about the fact that having everyone's kicking out time being the same time might be a problem. And, you know, I think there are multiple reasons. Also not forgetting that it's good to be able to sell more alcohol, which is taxed, and all of these things. So I think by the time you get later into the 90s, there's much more space in existing nightclub zones in towns for this kind of music to basically return to the cities, which it does. And arguably that is a great thing musically. I mean, the kind of music that's getting played in small clubs in London, the mid to late 90s, is music that has, you know, probably never been surpassed in quality and originality. You know, we have the high points of drum and bass, for example. And drum and bass and jungle, to an extent, are very urban, indoorsy genres, as is garage. You know, the garage doesn't exist in the middle of a field in West Mercia, you know. So I don't think the return to cities is necessarily a bad thing in that sense. But what it's all leading up to, I think, is this really quite bizarre era, when you look back on it, of clubbing becoming a creative industry of some kind, that it's seen as part of a, well, what we would now call the nighttime economy. And huge raves are tolerated as long as they are, you know, ticketed and licensed and approved in advance. And so you have things like the Big Beach Boutique in Brighton, which is basically a complete disaster. 250,000 people turn up in Brighton, cause chaos, or rather sort of forced to cause chaos, because there are so many people, it's impossible to do crowd control properly. You know, people are seriously hurt. And this is in 2002. Clubbing and club culture is very mainstream by that time. It's considered to be something that a broad swathe of the public can take part in. The Big Beach Boutique is partly organised by Channel 4. And after this chaotic disaster, which, you know, results in thousands of pounds of damage and serious injury to people, Brighton Council go away and have a hard think about it. And they come back and say, actually, we'll keep doing this. We can keep doing this because we're just going to put in some new safety measures and just tweak a few things and it'll be okay. And as Ed Gillett points out in the book, all of this damage, all of this chaos is just the cost of doing business, ultimately.
And if it's put in those terms, then it becomes acceptable.
Right. And there are all kinds of events that are considered acceptable despite the damage that they cause, the, you know, the rubbish and waste that they leave behind. I mean, we even saw it perhaps at the beginning of COVID, where there was a lot of pearl clutching about the last few music events that continued to happen in that last one or two weekends as lockdown descended. But meanwhile, I think it was Cheltenham Races that happened that weekend. Huge event. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, there's a lot less concern about what's going on there compared to a festival, for example.
Or, I mean, at the end of lockdown, when there was the England-Italy football final at Wembley, and it wasn't approved of. I mean, certainly the way what happened in the run-up to that game and afterwards was not written about approvingly in the press, but no one ever suggested we're going to ban football matches.
No, exactly. There's something about the fact that because it's clearly making money for people and, of course, serving a certain faction of society, then it's almost just seen as unstoppable. And I think there's something about dance music's trajectory here, where by the time you get to the Big Beach Boutique, it's become commercialised and normalised to the extent that no one can really make an argument against it anymore, which is just, it's really mind-boggling to think about the difference in attitudes within the space of about 6 or 7 years.
And how much is sort of the rise of the superstar DJ connected to that? I mean, is it also less worrying if you have to have, as it were, Norman Cook being the demagogue above his crowd, you know, sort of the return of the tyrant after you have this moment of non-hierarchical free party spaces, the DJ's playing the music, but it's not about the figure of the DJ necessarily. And then instead, then you have this thing where you have Fatboy Slim commanding his loyal followers, and that's sort of more acceptable because there is a hierarchy there.
Yeah, I think perhaps it's maybe less to do with there being a superstar DJ, because some people had argued that around the time of the campaign against the Criminal Justice Act, that what was missing from that movement was a true figurehead. And that was perhaps what was scary about that movement, is that if only they'd nominated a leader for themselves, you know, perhaps it should have been Keith Flint from The Prodigy or something. It wouldn't have been. But, you know, if they'd had a leader, would that movement have been yet more scary and powerful? But on the other hand, I mean, Norman Cook, he's perfect, isn't he? Nice guy, Hawaiian shirt, he's from Brighton. Everyone can understand that. I mean, you only need to look at the amazing recent episode of University Challenge, where this poor team were asked a series of dance music questions, which they tried. But basically, there's a hilarious clip of them being, I think, quite unfairly denied their answer. They're asked about a genre and asked to name a genre, and they go for drum and bass, but apparently the answer is jungle. It's very, I don't know, I think it was unfair. But then in another one of the questions in this round on University Challenge, they get asked who is the godfather of house, and they rack their brains and they're thinking about it. And fair enough, if you're not into dance music, that's quite a difficult question. But they go for Fatboy Slim, and I think there's something about the ease with which someone like a Fatboy Slim can kind of slip into this culture and just make it look just fine, just normal, just a kind of, you know, your friendly neighborhood DJ. Whereas, of course, the godfather of house is Frankie Knuckles, a gay black man from Chicago who, you know, invented house music in the 80s, basically. So I think the fact that someone like Norman Cook comes along for you to put all your trust in, if you like, is maybe not coincidental to the purification and the acceptance of rave.
And making it whiter as well.
Exactly.
I mean, you write about the way that happened with Kiss FM, that began as a pirate radio station and then ended up being sort of playing mainstream pop with all white DJs.
Yeah. So pirate radio, obviously, huge element in all of this, or at least if you lived somewhere where you could get pirate radio. Kiss FM is really one of the big stations of the acid house movement. They try quite hard to get a proper license. It's in a very strange time for radio in general, where it's really difficult to get a license. And it's before, you know, it's when Thatcher's government is still deciding how much they want to deregulate radio. And part of the reason they're worried about deregulating it is because they can see all of these radio stations who are going to ask for a license are radio stations like PCRL in Birmingham. They are not only black owned, but, you know, potentially are transmitting some fairly serious black politics on the airwaves. Anyway, Kiss FM is a mixed station. It has black and white DJs. They're playing acid house. They eventually get their license, but in a very predictable trajectory over the next 10 years, they succumb to commercial pressures, basically. And as they succumb to commercial pressures, gradually throughout the 90s, the station becomes more and more white. It plays less and less specialist dance music. And about 10 years after they get their license, every single presenter on the station is white. And so it's really just a normal commercial radio station that exists to, you know, play you advertising jingles from local companies and so on. But pirate radio continues to be a major force. It just shifts to new stations every few years. So you've got Cool FM, of course, Rinse FM, which still exists. And they are crucibles for musical innovation for a good 15 years.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And that question of technological change, I mean, the idea of the days when if you wanted to listen to new music, you either had to go out to listen to it or find a radio station that would play it, or, you know, or buy it at a record store, or get a mixtape from a friend and so on. But the idea, you couldn't just turn on your phone and go to Spotify or to YouTube or to any of those other sources of music. I mean, and how much has that shift to the way that most people listen to music mostly on their phones now? How has that changed things?
So this is a very large question. So I think it's worth just thinking about, if we're talking about listening to music in general, then, you know, that's huge in itself. You know, the technological changes to the way we listen to music, and very particularly to the way that music is distributed now, which means the end of record shops, has sort of been probably the most significant development in pop culture terms, I would even argue, in the last 20 years, really. But if we think about it in terms of dance music, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was quite often the case that when you went to a rave, you were hearing brand new music. Maybe it was produced that month or week. And so you wouldn't be able to go home and listen to it. You'd probably have to wait for quite a long time to actually get your hands on the record, by which time the music you were hearing at the rave had moved on anyway. And that is basically because this period of dance music is all a result of the proliferation of the kind of electronic music technology, like samplers and sequencers, that had first been invented in, you know, the 60s and 70s, and were now trickling down to people in their small studios, their bedroom studios. And all of this sort of democratization of this high-tech equipment fuels this period of huge innovation, which lasts, I mean, I think arguably it lasts about 10 years, really. So from 86 to 96, the acceleration of dance music, of what it sounds like, is kind of unprecedented, and I think feeds into a lot of today's nostalgia for it. But you obviously would be listening to music at the rave, and you could go home and listen to it if you tuned into pirate radio. And you could also maybe buy a tape pack. You know, you could get a cassette that had a DJ mix on it that was maybe recorded at a rave that you'd been at. But I think that one of the reasons that this is a cultural change and, you know, arguably a huge loss is the inbuilt sociality to all of this, because in order to get hold of this music, you kind of had to talk to someone. I mean, in order to even go to a rave, compared to going to a gig maybe, you really need to go with people. You would go home, listen to pirate radio, and call the radio. You call up, leave a message, they'd read it out. Someone else who's listening, who you know, hears that message, maybe it's a message to them. You hear some records that you like, maybe you decide you want to get into DJing, you have to go to the record shop. You're probably going to have to meet the people who run the record shop, and so on and so on. And this kind of circuit of material things and, you know, real people, I think doesn't exist at all anymore. I mean, very, very little of that now exists. My engagement with dance music mostly is, you know, listening to recorded mixes on the internet. I don't even own them. I just stream them. Discover some DJs that I like. Go to see them if they're playing. I mean, I wouldn't go on my own, so I have to. I definitely. It's a social experience to go out. But the enjoyment of the music when I'm not in the rave is pretty much entirely privatized at this point. Whereas I think in the early 90s, discovering rave meant discovering a group of people that you would then spend a lot of time with, you know, maybe 48 hours at a stretch, right? So I think that's the crucial difference to how the technology has changed. And it's something that the book touches on briefly with reference to Mark Fisher, who talks about this idea that the clampdown on rave was part of this broader process that sees individuals being produced, that sees the crowd being, as he put it, decomposed into solitary consumers. And that's not just in rave culture, that's all over society. I mean, the example that Mark Fisher gives is in football culture. And he talks about how the Hillsborough disaster was a turning point that ended up sort of accelerating a kind of, well, corporate takeover of football. You know, standing terraces were banned, seats brought in, and this kind of individualized experience starts to extend across society, really. So this is how we get back to this sense that some of the problem with rave was that it was swimming against a tide of capitalism, specifically this sort of late or neoliberal capitalism that we live under, where the individual unit is so primary and everything is privatized. Mark Fisher calls it an act of psychic privatization, this process throughout the 90s in particular.
I mean, is there a counter-argument to that, that in the old days, if you wanted to play it, you'd have to probably buy some records, and records cost money and it was expensive, and there was a ways that, I mean, is there a way in which actually the availability through the internet is, as well as being decomposing crowds into solitary consumers, it is also opening it up and democratizing. And I mean, there is a sort of counter current there as well.
Yeah, I think that's true to an extent. And I mean, funnily enough, it was probably in the 90s and maybe even amongst this type of community that people were making this argument quite forcefully, the idea that, you know, information wants to be free, and thinking in a kind of techno-utopian sense about the direction of travel here. We want to accelerate into this, you know, frictionless future, and we're going to listen to jungle while we do it. But I think I feel like that opinion is perhaps less often heard now, because we've reached a kind of terminus here where so few people in music are able to make any kind of money whatsoever, because records don't cost any money, because live events are so expensive to put on, not just in dance music, but gigging, you know, touring, gigging is so much more expensive than it was before. Brexit added to that. In dance music, the gentrification of inner cities has made it harder to put on events, you know, where, in places that they used to be, in the center of towns. Licensing decisions are punitive a lot of the time, and councils tend to take the side of their smart new residents who've moved into perhaps formerly commercial areas. There are so many ways in which this shift has taken any kind of economic power base away from artists. I think my heart would want to say that this is a good thing, and that I probably would have been on the side of the information wants to be free people some years ago. But now I just feel like we're at the stage where you're leaving people really with nothing. And I don't think it holds in the same way as it would have done in the late 90s.
And also in a way that the internet has gone through the same process that rave culture has, from these early days where it seems, where, you know, it's utopian and this idea of freedom and non-hierarchical, and then there's the way in which it gets consolidated and commercialized and packaged and commodified and bought up by a small number of large owners. And
yeah, they're completely parallel histories in a sense.
I mean, is there a... This is another quite a large question. I mean, did the... Well, not the drug trade, but the ecstasy trade specifically go through the similar kind of process that in the early days, that now it's sort of mass produced on a giant scale in factories and largely in the Netherlands, but elsewhere. But in the mid to late 80s or the early in 87, 88, it was quite hard to get hold of. The kind of people, I've heard it said that, as it were, aficionados, hobbyists were making it and distributing it to their friends. And there was a kind of cottage industry in the distribution of ecstasy. And then that became very rapidly commercialized and, I mean, but obviously illegally.
So, well, ecstasy has a really quite strange history, actually. And I think, so perhaps just to rewind a bit, because it's sort of worth mapping out just slightly. But so ecstasy is accidentally discovered or you know, discovered in the course of pharmaceutical research in the 1910s. It's not used for anything for ages. It's rediscovered in the 60s and 70s. Famously by Alexander and Anne Shulgin. And then at some point in the 70s, I'm not quite sure how this works. I guess it just happens in a sort of off-prescription way through the sort of psychedelic networks of the West Coast in America. But therapists and psychiatrists start using MDMA in therapeutic settings. Again, I think sort of off-prescription. They just try it out. They get good results. They pass it around. And from there, it starts to seep out into recreational use. So it's a sort of hippie thing and then later a dance scene. It was actually huge in Dallas in the early 80s at this amazing sounding club called the Stark Club, which is well worth reading about. It's really another time. But then there's this incredible connection with Ibiza specifically via the devotees of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, which if you saw that Wild Wild Country documentary, you will know a lot about. And so after the Rajneeshis are booted out of their Oregon commune, where they'd been doing lots of, you know, free love and presumably LSD parties. So they're kicked out of there. And as they sort of scatter around the world, they end up in various sort of hippie hotspots around the world, like Goa, obviously big dance music hotspot historically, and Ibiza. And they open this meditation center on Ibiza. and supposedly bring MDMA with them, which they'd first encountered through the commune from living on the West Coast. This is all quite under-researched, but it seems likely that they knew about MDMA, had the meditation center, and then they made a connection with other Rajneeshis who'd ended up in the Netherlands and set up this supply route so that by the time the Ibiza 4 land in Ibiza in the 80s, ecstasy is available there, you know? And the reason that they could get it from the Netherlands is that the Netherlands were already, that there were already these Dutch labs making amphetamines throughout the 80s. And as Gillett explains, part of the reason that the Dutch labs start making ecstasy is that when the wall comes down, cheap amphetamines from the East start sort of flooding the market. And they realize that if they switched this basically more sort of exclusive, I guess harder to make and expensive to sell drug, that it's good for business. And the Rajneeshis aren't afraid of doing a bit of business either. You know, famously, Rajneesh had like a fleet of Rolls Royces and, you know. So I don't know. I mean, the idea that it's a sort of artisanal product that then becomes like commercialized, I guess there's something in that. But I mean, you know, I suppose you could theorize now an MDMA lab in which the workers shared the profits or something. But ultimately, all of this, you know, this is about criminalization, right? Because of criminalization, there's no way to have anything other than a sort of profit-making relationship to the consumer, I guess. I don't know that... I think it's fair to say that ecstasy was commercialized, but I'm unsure about the sort of limits of that when you're talking about an illegal product.
But I suppose, this is sort of a way into another question, that the idea that, you know, what it was like in 1987, you describe how Gillett is rightly scathing about the way rave has been co-opted, not only as a creative industry and degenerating into business techno, but also by the heritage industry, that there are films and exhibitions about it. And he describes going to a virtual reality reconstruction of a rave from 1992. I don't know, it seems so missing the point, you know, funded by the Arts Council and all the rest of it. But at times it sounds as if the book itself, in a different way, a different kind of nostalgia. I mean, I assume that I get the sense that he's too young to have been part. He wasn't there in 1987, right?
No.
So is there, and in the same way that even at the time, it was itself nostalgic for an imagined version of the 60s, calling itself the Second Summer of Love as a throwback to kind of, we can have our own version of 1967, which we were too young to be part of at the time. Mm. I mean, is there a kind of nostalgia in that?
Well, I would say, first of all, that I don't really think beyond that sort of media-dubbed Second Summer of Love that many people in the rave scene were thinking about the 60s particularly. I think that's probably... It may have occurred to them early on, but I think by the time you get to sort of 92, 93, there's something that feels quite radically new about it. And that's, you know, that is largely because of how completely bonkers the music sounded, you know. Whether or not Gillett is being a little overly nostalgic for this era in his own way, well, you know what, I think he probably is. I imagine that the pull of that nostalgia is really what drew him to researching the book in the first place, rather than writing a book about dance music right now, which would be, I mean, some of it comes up to the present day, of course. I think his perspective is that all of these misty-eyed films and exhibitions show us ultimately this culturally exorcised version of rave, right? So the clocks are stuck in 1992, but we can't go back. And so I think it serves the purpose then of sealing off the past. And he's annoyed, obviously, that we're spending all of this time thinking about the past and not the present. This VR experience that you mentioned, yeah, it's funded by the BFI and the Arts Council. So you've got money lavished on preserving this particular idea of the past in Aspic. Meanwhile, clubs now, musicians now are, you know, very unevenly supported, particularly during the pandemic. Clubbing in general is in decline. Clubs can't afford the rent, etc. But I think that when you have actually familiarised yourself with the workings of this early rave movement, you know, the quality and variety of the music and the descriptions of the raves themselves, you know, whether it was like a five-day free party led by a traveller convoy or a mega rave with funfair rides and chill-out zones and oxygen bars, all everything about the secret locations, the pirate radio, the record shops, and the sheer kind of immediacy and IRL-ness of it. And then you actually imagine getting to experience that for the first time. You know, all this music that just sounds like nothing that's ever been made before. And it's for you, your subculture, like now, not just for everybody. And I just think that is why, you know, my generation and Ed Gillett's generation have been obsessing over 90s rave for the last, you know, 15 years. Because it's not really just about the raves. It's like an entire way of being culturally and subculturally that has basically faded away. So I don't think that's just a nostalgia. I think you could argue that that is the preservation of a cultural collective memory and the memory of a possibility, the memory of collectivity, and that in itself is like a bastion against this cultural exorcism that Mark Fisher talks about. And yeah, you know, I think it's actually important to preserve the real complexity of rave in our minds in this world where, of course, we've learned that there's no alternative. You know, it's like this idea that the failed revolutions are not failed because they will ultimately be redeemed by the future revolution, right? But I do think that there's something about keeping that memory potent and complicated that is way more than just nostalgia. But as you can tell, I'm obviously very partial to exactly the same kind of nostalgia.
I mean, and there have been moments of despite all the recuperation in my head, they were quite recent. But then looking back, actually, it was quite a long time ago. But that in 2010, which is, you know,
eons ago, in dance music terms, that's just
well, yeah, and in all sorts of terms. But more recent than the 90s, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
The Royal Mail sorting office, very near the LRB offices, that had shut down, and before, I mean, it's been knocked down and rebuilt and redeveloped. But in this. There was this very large empty building in central London, and then Halloween 2010, a lot of people broke in and held a drum and bass rave called Scummerween.
Mm.
And that, even in 2010 or shortly before that happened, it didn't seem that sort of thing was possible in central, certainly not in central London anymore. And yet there was this recrescence, if that's a word. So I don't know, there are these, that it is, no, it can still happen.
It can and does, yeah. I mean, illegal raves still happen in London. I think the fact is that they're just usually a bit more careful to keep themselves to themselves. You know, they happen in warehouses. They happen.
They're not in WC1.
No, they're in industrial estates. They're in grubby brownfield patches next to motorways and canals, and you know, on Hackney Marshes or whatever. So, I mean, there was actually another really big party by that same crew, Scumtech, in 2015 in Lambeth, which also ended up in a sort of police confrontation. And actually, I had a quick look for some others that hit the news. And there was another one in another Royal Mail sorting office, but in Croydon in 2014. But I don't think that was actually a Scumtech one, but same sort of thing. The reason that 2010 one got so much police attention and news coverage is firstly that it was really big, obviously, which meant that the police couldn't really shut it down, right? Because it would have been dangerous to do so. So therefore it goes on for a long time. So therefore it hits the news. I mean, sometimes the police just shut raves down still, right? But obviously it was also seen as anomalous because it was bang in the middle of central London. Perhaps the context to add here then is, why is there a building in central London as massive as this that's just standing there empty, right? It comes back to the point about these empty warehouses in Blackburn and Leeds just sort of waiting for a rave to happen inside them, arguably. So I think the suggestion that you're making that that's the kind of last in a line, I don't think is quite right. As I said, illegal parties definitely go on, maybe not on the same scale. I thought it would be interesting to just make a note about Scumtech, though. So Scumtech, who organised Scumoween, they're a sound system collective who have put on free parties, I think mainly in London for a long time. And I know that they've actually been quite explicit about holding free parties in bankrupt properties, such as a sold off government building, right? Like a Royal Mail sorting office. They have actually specifically talked about being a response to clubs being refused a license, to the gentrification of cities that makes, you know, living a creative life in a city so difficult. And so they choose commercial spaces, I think, in order also to take advantage of sort of what remains of squatting rights, which can give them more time to set up. And I think historically they do this sort of in team with homeless people who will then stay in the building until a court eviction. I don't know if that would still be possible, but I think that's how they were operating about five or 10 years ago. So Scumtech, you know, like other free party organisers, like Red Tech, who are the revolutionary socialist equivalent, and then national events like Egg Tech, which is the sort of national Easter sound system meetup, you know, they still exist. And I think it's important to note that they're really on a separate kind of wavelength to most of the rest of the dance music culture that Ed Gillett is writing about. It's probably an important missing chapter in the book, to be honest. I think that would be a really interesting thing to investigate, the persistence of these, you know, crusty rave crews, some 30 years after the fact. They are very distant from this business techno culture that Ed Gillett very memorably describes.
I mean, the other thing about that one in 2010, it was right next door to The End, the nightclub that was certainly a good place to be in the 90s, but which, you know, has then since shut down. And I think, again, maybe one of those places where property guardians lived in it. So that thing that you're saying that Scumtech do with housing homeless people in there, that there is a thing that property developers also do that to keep squatters out, that they have had these people known as property guardians who are put in. So, I mean, that those two places. And I think The End, I don't know if it still does, but for a while it definitely had signs saying this property is protected, bought, occupied, or whatever, by property guardians.
Yeah. Imagine that. Imagine living in there, though. What, is your bedroom just room one? I don't... How would they split it up? It's hard to imagine. That was a great club, though.
You know, another one, it's not quite the same thing, but that was described as a rave. That's probably what it was, a rave, by that the Daily Mail got very exercised about in 2015, that in the jungle refugee camp in Calais, that there was this theatre company, the Good Chance Theatre Company, who'd set up a geodesic dome to provide a space for people who living in that refugee camp for theatre events and other kinds of events. I mean, a social space, which there weren't very many of there. And on the day that it was built, and the people who lived in the camp all got to, you know, put the dome up all together, and then once it was built, they had a dance party, as who would not? And the Daily Mail seems so outraged about it. Kind of, how dare these people enjoy themselves? They're meant to be desperate, and here they are having a party. I don't know. But the idea of who's allowed to have fun, it seems to be quite an important part of this and the censoriousness of it.
Oh, well, nobody's allowed to have fun. Nobody's allowed to have fun in that worldview. I mean, it's sort of true, though, isn't it? There's not really any fun allowed in that worldview. That says a lot about the culture that we live in more broadly, and perhaps also why raves seemed so outlandish when it arrived. I mean, we are, or I am, a sort of white Northern European of Protestant extraction type of person. We have been banning dancing for centuries. You know, we've been banning raves in various different ways for centuries. It's something that Barbara Ehrenreich talks about in her really fantastic book, Dancing in the Streets, which is this a history of collective joy. She doesn't mention rave culture at all. She doesn't even get that far, but it's not necessary, because what she's really explaining is a centuries old, maybe millennia old history of cracking down on, again, this idea of collective festivity, this all of the things that it might represent, a sense of excess. You know, one of the earliest collectives who were stopped from gathering to dance was obviously the Dionysian cults of the Roman Empire. Women loved it. Women apparently were hugely drawn to the Dionysian cults. Throughout the Middle Ages, you have clampdowns on sort of local carnival-like events. Carnival itself, hugely prescribed by colonial governments. This idea of people getting together and putting some loud music on is just upsetting to a certain class of, I guess you could say in particular, property owning. But in the past, there was obviously a religious and moral dimension to it. I think it's taken all kinds of shapes over the millennia. And that's why maybe Alan Lodge, as I was mentioning at the beginning, this stalwart veteran of the scene, he is able to trace this antagonism right back to nomads and hunter-gatherers versus the settlers. I think there are some really, really fundamental human qualities to this entire argument that rave culture is just a fragment of. And yeah, you're right. The idea that obviously they would put some music on, you know, there's something obvious about getting together, playing some music, dancing to it. That really is something that humans of all societies and cultures historically have done. And for reasons that anthropologists think are really fundamental to, you know, things like solidifying group dynamics beyond just your blood relations, for example, solidifying your relationship with kith and kin. Lots of different suggestions as to what dance is for, but definitely what it seems to be for is cheering us up. There's just no doubt that dancing, there are studies showing that dance is the most effective form of exercise to treat depression in a study comparing it to SSRIs. It's really fundamental, and I think treated as a luxury or a sort of peripheral facet of human life at our peril, I think. So yeah, I'm not sure that white English people have always been the most willing to accept getting off your head and having a dance party, but there you go.
Thank you, Charles Ravens, very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You can read Charles' piece in the 7th of March issue of the LRB. A new issue is out today with Rosemary Hill on British and Irish architecture, Paul Taylor on AI, and Pankaj Mishra's winter lecture on the Shoah after Gaza. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourn. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.